You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to another edition of the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today's date being July 16th, 2025. And of course, I have no choice but to discuss the strange behavior of Donald Trump relative to the Ukraine situation. I could discuss it with regard to many other situations. The only thing he's not erratic on is Israel, of course. Well, not quite a month ago, we had the NATO summit at The Hague, a unique one. And this is one of the things that Trump had campaigned on, to force NATO members to become more self-sufficient. And one of the ways he wanted to do this was to increase European military spending. He wanted initially 2%, which they haven't met. Now he wants 5%, which they won't meet. So, you know, whatever cuts they would ever have to make, Europe is the EU is, NATO is a dying organization, it's a threat to nobody. But they were cutting pensions and education to begin with, especially in France. With the migrant invasion, that's even worse. So there's no way he's getting this 5%. But this is the nature of the European Union. No one wants war. No one in the European Union, no normal person wants war, and certainly not a war against Russia. But whether it be, you know, the European Union or NATO, this oligarchy decides that all of this money has to be spent to fight this invented and contrived archenemy, Russia, which, in fact, has done nothing wrong. But how would a united Europe be able to accept anything like this? By their own doing, their economy is dying. Destroyed, decimated, on purpose. And it's not just the sanctions, either. Yeah, these are very unique circumstances. I don't believe official numbers. But since 2021, I think the growth numbers have been like 1%. And I think the only reason they do that is to avoid having to admit that it's a depression. Spain, for example, is spending like 2.1% on its military budget, 2.1% of its GDP. But that's way too much for its faltering economy. What they consider growth has everything to do with financial derivatives and profits, having nothing to do with actual production. But Trump made it a point to approach the Prime Minister of Spain, Pedro Sanchez, and say, sanctions are always possible on you. And it goes for all of Europe, of course. 50% import duties. See, there's been no recovery since 2008, let alone the COVID collapse of 2020. This 5.2% in 2021, that was money printed at will and given to the elite. That had nothing to do with economic growth. It's been zero. Certainly it's been negative numbers for several years. There's been no recovery. And these are even you know, saying it's 0.5% in 2023 and 1% in 2024, those are dubious and not to mention very broad figures. And it doesn't take inflation into account. So even if they're true, inflation has clearly eliminated whatever growth that they have. So they're projecting that for the rest of this year, it's going to be 1.4% in the EU, which is a lie, as are all the EU's unemployment figures. And plus, the debt burden that the EU carries is unsustainable, especially when there's no economic growth. It's not the case in the East. Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, China, averaging 7-8% by purchasing power parity. People throw around the GDP growth as if it's really meaningful. I mean, it's very, very general. But the one time it is worthwhile is when you use the PPP version. NATO Secretary General, the new one, Mark Rutte, who was a former Prime Minister of Holland, who came out of the Klaus Schwab's Young Global Leaders Program, was falling all over himself to please Trump and demanded that people accept the 5% GDP defense spending for this dying region. And it was a bit of a surprise for the president. He may have expected some resistance, and he received very little. And so in disgust, he left the NATO summit to go to something equally ridiculous, that of the G7 in Canada. G7, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the UK, and the US. And unlike the previous summits, Zelensky was sidelined in The Hague. Israel comes first, remember. But after he left in disgust, Rutte said, I don't know if it was tongue-in-cheek or what, but he said, this is a stronger, fairer, more lethal alliance the NATO leaders have begun to build. Nothing about peace, of course. He said, Trump made it clear America is committed to NATO, but the president also made clear that America expects European allies and Canada to contribute more. And that's exactly what we see all of us doing. Of course, this is the same guy that said, Daddy has to sometimes use strong language to get them to stop, in reference to Iran and Israel. Trump, of course, did not return the pleasant words. I doubt it's going to even be close to met. And I think he knows that. Maybe 10% will be the thing he says next time. I don't know, he might as well. Hopefully this may see the end of this, of NATO. NATO is a paper tiger, especially today. But far more importantly than any of that, the 71st Bilderberg meeting took place in June. Many of you know that I attempted to infiltrate the one in Chantilly, Virginia, in 2002 with the guys from the American Free Press. I went to the front desk and I said, I'm a graduate student from the University of Colorado, and I've been invited here, you know, to hear some of these speeches. And of course they didn't believe me. And, there was a huge number of security personnel that materialized out of nowhere behind me. Like 20 people. And so I said, I guess I better go. But, you know, when I say the word regime, the highest level of that is the Bilderberg meeting. Bilderberg is just a nickname. Remember, back then, the system was denying that it even exists. Now they have their own website. But those who show up, these are the people who rule the planet. It's typical military, journalists, tech, bankers, whatever. One attendee was from the White House, Michael Kratsios, Science and Technology Policy. Of course, New York Times was there, The Economist, Bloomberg, not to cover it, but to get their marching orders from it. The head of Disney, Gerhard Zeiler, one of the heads of Disney, I should say. And, of course, Rutte himself was there. Two major American generals were there. Not to mention many major defense contractors, a Saab from Sweden, of course, Thales, Pfizer was there, Microsoft, of course, is always there, Spotify. I don't know why Spotify was there, but they've been there for the last few years. No one from China. No one from Russia. That's far more significant because these are the people who set the tone. Now, people like Fink from BlackRock and Rockefellers and Rothschilds, they're not considered attendees. They run the thing. I saw all the Rockefellers there in 2002. I saw them coming in their Lincolns from the airport. So that's just as a matter of course. These are specific attendees. But this is where these policies are decided. This is what the regime is. This ruling class, but the highest level of that ruling class is to be found at Bilderberg. And those who put it together. There was no, when I tried to infiltrate it in 2002, there was no reference to it. And even the local, it was in Chantilly, local Northern Virginia press, nothing. The most powerful people in the world were showing up here, Westfield's resort, whatever it was, and no one reported it. No one mentioned it. Washington Post wouldn't mention it. You would think that this is something, most powerful people are showing up to be in one place for a couple of days. God knows what they do. But unfortunately, I couldn't get in. I would love to tell you. Regardless of that, I don't know why Macron thinks he has some power here. The truth is, Europe does not have the strength to send a force anywhere, let alone to Ukraine. They couldn't impose peace. Russia is the world's premier military force in the world. They're battle-hardened. They have a tremendous industrial complex. They could produce anything. A tremendous scientific complex. They're producing, 1,000 tanks a year. But if he were to enter before a peace agreement is reached, of course that would be suicidal. The Germans think the same thing. But the French president said on July 11th, he used that coalition of the willing nonsense again, that they would patrol Ukraine's air and sea space after Moscow and Kiev reached a ceasefire agreement. And he came out and said, stupidly, that the point is to rebuild Ukraine's armed forces to continue the war later. Now, he's been talking like this for a while. This is nothing new. But, of course, all of this, and NATO being as weak as it is, they have very little by way of materiel anymore. Their defense ministers are mostly female. They have no connection to the defense industry at any point. But the German Chancellor, Merz, said Germany will continue to support Ukraine despite it being extremely unpopular. Macron in France doesn't have the majority to do much of anything. In France, over 9 million voters voted for the national rally. The anti-globalist left version received 7 million votes. So he's being squeezed. Now, of course, he has no problem with the leftist version. But this touted group, Macron and his Renaissance, this coalition, which was given endless media support, received only 5 million. He doesn't have the consent of really any substantial faction. I don't believe those vote figures anyway. Now, according to Gallup and Pew, a few other places, Macron mentioned sending forces to Ukraine. It was less than 10% of the French citizens who accepted it, who believed he should do it. But that, again, doesn't matter. He's just an alienated representative of Davos, and he has zero support. But at some point, they're going to have to treat Russia as a normal country. They're not going to beat them because Russia provides the most important metal and non-metal ores, semi-finished products, and energy for the French economy. That's why this has been suicidal from the beginning. Without cooperation from Russia, Germany's economy is suffering. There's been no growth there. There, of course, the alternative for Germany, directly against this kind of thing. And they received, 25%, although, of course, with endless campaigns against them, official campaigns, threats, you know, including threats saying that if you vote for them, you can go to prison for hate crimes. Then those who opposed on the left, you know, had about 8%. But this is not the Napoleonic era. Somehow they think that they have the forces, the power, the experience to do anything like this. Donald Trump has excluded Europe from deciding on any of these issues, which is fine by me, although, of course, he has no right to do it either. He campaigned on the peacemaking agenda. But unlike Merz or Macron, he does have certain strategic goals, sort of. Trump realizes that Ukraine can't win this in any way. Ukraine can't do anything on the battlefield, no matter how much help they get. And of course, he didn't start this. So the attempt is to get Russia to compromise. Russia has learned a lot since the old nonsense Minsk agreements. But Russia's demands have been identical for 20 years. A neutral and demilitarized Ukraine. Kremlin is only going to, of course, has all the momentum on their side, is not going to sign a premature peace. Foreign Minister Lavrov commented on the French president's statement saying that, I don't think this guy's paying attention to this multinational core. So we don't particularly deal with it, but they're shouting about it loudly. We can't ignore it. However, you don't take the various fantasies of those who want to show themselves on the international stage seriously. Now, this all dovetails into the major statement, which is what this show is about, on Russia that Trump made just a few days ago, trying to split the difference between escalating U.S. involvement and walking away from it. The major statement has three components, as many of you know. The first is the funniest. The rapid dispatch of up to 17 Patriot missile systems, although it's unclear if these are systems or missiles. One Patriot battery is about $1.5 billion, with a trained crew. They're going to have to be connected with all of the whole military system is connected with it. Satellites and everything else. You can't just dump it over there. Every time the Patriots have all been destroyed there, and in Israel too. Israel's always going to come first. There's only that so many in the world. You're talking about if there's 17 systems, each system costing $5-6 billion if you include missiles, with no crew available. I'll believe it when I see it. The second one is arms sales to NATO countries that will then transfer them to Ukraine. In other words, there will be reimbursement. And then up to 100% secondary sanctions on Russia's trading partners if a peace deal isn't reached in 50 days. Secondary sanctions, that's not a concept in international political economy, but it refers to a friend of a friend. If Russia doesn't, this is to force Russia's hand, force Russia to the table, it's not going to work. Partially because Russia really doesn't trade much with the U.S. Trump has been a disappointment to the Russian government. They didn't, although when he was first elected, they said we don't expect much. And somehow they're going to be bolstering Ukraine's air defenses, which hasn't been functional in a very long time. This belief that they could ever recover its lost land. Of course, this is Russian land. They all speak Russian there. And the secondary sanctions aimed at coercing China and India in particular into pressuring Russia into a ceasefire. That's going to backfire severely. This is all completely unrealistic. China and India's large-scale imports of discounted Russian oil. This has been a huge part of Russia's ability to deal with the sanctions, stabilize the rubles. It proved to everyone, of course, I said this 25 years ago, that the East is the future, not the West, at least not the West under this kind of government. These imports also help their own economies. But Trump is wagering that they're going to at least curtail them to avoid this 100% sanction rate, which would be secondary sanctions because really it's on Russia. But he'll make an exception for the EU and the Turks, of course. There's some good reason for them to make an exception of the Turks I can't get into right now. Point being is to reduce the budgetary revenue Kremlin receives from these sales. Well, trying to split the core of BRICS and the SCO, thinking that China or India is going to comply. And these leaders, both the Chinese and the Indians, are close friends with Putin for a very long time, are not going to pressure Putin into anything. He's created a dilemma of his own making. He's either going to have to delay the imposition of these 100% secondary sanctions, lower the level, maybe, or reduce the scale, or maybe only... sanctions, I wrote a paper on it, if you go to my Patreon, on what sanctions law is. You can't just have sanctions. It has to be on a very specific part of the economy. You have to mention the companies. You have to mention the products, why they're connected with the policy goal, say a military or whatever. You can't just have blanket sanctions. You can't tell American businessmen what to do. Sanctions have to be very specific. So there's no such thing as a blanket sanction. Plus, the president has full ability to change it or eliminate it at will. That's how sanctions law is done. There has to be there's a list of people and a list of... That's the only way you can enforce it anyway. He thinks that he's reset his relations with the Chinese. The Chinese don't need the U.S. The U.S. needs the Chinese. The Indians don't like being bullied this way. They've only been an independent country for a short time. And the backlash might be this rapprochement between India and China. Of course, they're divided over Pakistan, and that's actually occurring. This is clumsy. It's going to backfire. It is backfiring. Someone told him that Russia is going to agree to a ceasefire that doesn't resolve the root issues. Putin has politely declined all of these premature ceasefires. Trump somehow took all of this personally. Imagine that Putin was playing him. And I think Trump's advisors manipulated him into this escalation as some sort of vengeance. But, you know, there is this so-called pivot. I think the pivot is just to get people to the table. It's not going to get Russia to the table. Of course, it's a tactical maneuver to placate elite pressure, maybe. But this is right after the Pentagon said they're not going to send any more weaponry to Ukraine. Just days later, and Trump reversed course, saying that the U.S. would send quote-unquote defensive weapons, whatever that might mean, to help Ukraine counter Russian advances. But what it comes down to, as we all know, is the continuation of terror tactics against Russian civilians. Trump's second term has been extremely erratic this way. He's underestimating these people. Initially, early in his presidency, his rhetoric was to de-escalate, thinking that he could, you know, broker this peace. The concept of peacemaker has, you know, I guess has been proven misleading. I mean, it's conceivable that this is just a way to destroy NATO. I have no problem with that whatsoever. Trump has said that NATO is going to pay 100% for these weapons that will be sent to Ukraine. I don't know if he knows this, but weapon stores are extremely low in the Western world. All of the obsolete things that they sent to Ukraine, all of them have been destroyed. I don't see what the point of it is anyway. It would be immediately annihilated the moment it lands on Ukrainian soil. The U.S. is completely overburdened in this respect. Trying to shift some of this onto NATO doesn't help. NATO can't do it. They probably won't do it. They don't have the capacity to do it. And it might mean the end of them. Especially when Macron is away, is gone, finally. But the defense sector is a powerful force. Patriot missile systems, now systems, take a long time to make. They don't have a very long lifespan. And who are they going to go to, Israel or Ukraine? They're going to Israel first. You're talking about billions upon billions. The Patriot is extremely expensive, and Ukraine doesn't have the crews. Ukraine can't purchase them, and they certainly can't use them. Sanction bill was, now he's in alliance with Lindsey Graham, a disgusting human being. The Sanctioning Russia Act of 2025. Since those sanctions on very specific areas, many areas, although specific areas, Russian industry, and in this act, there's a 500% tariff on countries purchasing Russian oil or other goods. He calls it a sledgehammer to hurt Moscow's economy, and it can't work. It's just going to alienate, and it's really aimed at India and China, and it's going to fail miserably. There's plenty of writers out there who think that this is just being done to please the regime. It's conceivable, although I don't know why he cares. He can't be reelected again. So much for any kind of isolationism or dismantling of NATO. If it leads to the destruction of NATO, fine. Demanding that they foot the bill for Ukraine's weaponry. And he did this in his first term, too, if you remember. It didn't go anywhere then. I don't know how it's going to go anywhere now, when they're far worse off economically. The national security state is not happy about this either. Ukraine has long served as proxy, frontline proxy for liberalism's war with Moscow, just like Albania and the Kosovo did with Serbia. But talking about 17 or more Patriot systems is just rhetoric. It's a ridiculous mythology that Trump was ever ally with Putin in any way, in his first term or in his second term. But there are domestic pressures and economic interests. NATO has an expansionist agenda. But escalating a conflict that's already been lost, that's been lost for years. Now, keep in mind, I do think that he's not this, some people are saying that he's just this irrational, erratic actor. No, he is not. It is a matter of using unpredictability, weaponizing it. He behaves as if he could do just about anything. Therefore, that will bring people to the table, force people to make concessions, other countries to make concessions they otherwise wouldn't make. But how long could that last before people realize this is a tactic? This man is highly rational. He took over the Republican Party. He destroyed the Bush-Clinton era. We're talking about a guy who, in a highly regulated and very Jewish area of Manhattan real estate, still became a billionaire. Even and now, after multiple prosecutions and even arrest. So as it stands now, Russia is still assessing. They're quite well aware of this, imposing these kind of severe sanctions on Moscow's allies. If this isn't resolved in 50 days, so like what I don't know, 45 days now. Peskov, the long-time spokesman, Trump said that he was very unhappy with Russia, warning of severe secondary tariffs, up to 100% if no progress in diplomacy is reached soon. He left the door open, though. He's disappointed in the Russian president. He's not finished with him. Peskov said that Russia has to process this. There's been calls, there's been phone calls, and nothing has come from them. Istanbul, nothing has come from it. As far as Ukraine is concerned, though, that's a signal to continue the war. A war that they don't even have the men to continue to fight. These are mercenaries at this point. Russia's going to be in charge here. This is their story. The Ukrainian president is illegitimate to begin with, but even if he were legitimate, his powers ran out in May of last year. He has absolutely no authority and has zero popularity. This has been as badly handled as the Epstein files. However, something else has come from this. When the NATO orchestrated conflict started in 2014, those of you who have been following me for a long time know I've been talking about it since then. I was the first to translate Novorossiya's Declaration of Independence and Constitution into English. That's still floating around out there somewhere. Of course, now they don't exist. They're a part of Russia now. But American, other multinationals rushed in to ensure that they profited from the misery of this poor country. I've discussed at great length. This is why, in my book, I have my book on the Russo-Ukrainian War of 2022. It's a problem. I don't want to release something and then have much of it be rendered null and void or moot. But I, for a long time, talked about how the laws have been changed. There's no normal, you know, legislature. You have four parties in Kiev. They all say the exact same thing. So it's a one-party state. They've permitted foreign companies to take over and do what they please. The life of independent Ukraine has been so bad, even Soviet Ukraine, it can't reach. It can't come close, in fact, to reaching Soviet Ukraine. Soviet Ukraine had a population of 52 million. Well-educated, mostly, working in various specialized fields, the scientific and industrial powerhouse I've been saying for a long time. Then after 1991, it collapsed for good. As I said at the time, early 1990s, this relatively prosperous Ukraine turned into a third world country with a fraction of its Soviet-era scientific and industrial presence, which, by the way, is in Donetsk and Luhansk. And today they're seen mostly as a agricultural producer. Cheap labor. Cheap resource for the regime's exploitation. By the mid-2010s, NATO hijacked this poor country and turned it into the illegitimate Jewish fanatical state that it is now, genociding its own population. The demographic collapse, which was severe even without the war, is now so catastrophic. You have about half of Ukraine's 1991 population in existence. And still the demands of whatever remains of Ukrainian resources. Now, I say all this because BlackRock seems to be pulling out. If BlackRock is pulling out, that should tell you that the regime is throwing up its hands, finally. They seem to be giving up on NATO-occupied Ukraine. Their multi-billion dollar Ukraine recovery fund is not being funded anymore. It's being suspended, not just because Trump was elected, but also because there was no way Ukraine could win. BlackRock stopped looking for institutional investors. That was back in January. All of these reconstruction efforts imply that Ukraine wins. That's not going to be the case. Now, the report they put out says that the investment interest stopped due to a lack of interest amid perceived uncertainty in Ukraine. In other words, no one wants to put billions into a endemically corrupt mafia state run by Jewish fanatics in the middle of an unwinnable war with a military superpower. Nobody sane would make any kind of investment in a country like this. and what is perceived uncertainty is. Russian military is advancing on many fronts. It's not a matter of perception. They're losing. There's nothing left. There hasn't been in a long time. Taxpayers are paying for mercenaries, organizations. Some poorly trained boys trained abroad have been thrown against the now battle-hardened Russians. But whatever BlackRock does, assuming it's, they mean it, that's the signal of signals. They say that their Ukraine recovery fund has no mandate. Well, they never had a mandate to begin with. France is trying to compensate for this. It cannot. Even that's falling through. Without American backing, nothing could occur anyway. EU investors are just as skeptical as anybody else. They know the truth, even though the mainstream media continues to lie that the Kiev regime is defeating Russia. They know better. The so-called mineral deal, I talked about it over the last, 6 months, I guess, that would fall through because Ukraine doesn't possess these minerals. Not to mention, in these regions, it's not under Kiev's control anyway. I went through all of these very important minerals, all the places where they are found, and Ukraine is not on the list. They have very little in this respect. These are prospectus. It might be there. That hasn't kept Zelensky from announcing his $1 trillion reconstruction plan. But that $1 trillion came from giving parts of Western Ukraine to whatever company wanted to buy it. Most of Ukrainian farmland in the West now, about 40% of it, has been handed over to Western agribusiness, who was using it to experiment in GMO crops. Now, there was an attempt. I keep saying that there's nothing. Why would Ukraine want to be a part of the EU when there's absolutely nothing that Ukraine makes that the EU can't make themselves? Cheap Ukrainian agricultural products did flood European markets after the whole African thing. And, of course, what you might expect are massive protests from farmers across Western Europe. So even that was a bad investment. Keep in mind that Russia's campaigning, and this has been the case almost from the beginning, has been intensely methodical. The point is to avoid both civilian casualties and casualties to themselves. Their casualties have been fairly low. But of course, that means you have to move very slowly, deliberately, grinding. But it is effective. Last month, Russia seized about 320 square miles of territory that's theirs to begin with. And there's a very specific method here. They know that most of the population of Eastern Ukraine is pro-Russian. They have no motive to hurt them in any way. This is why the Ukrainians engage in terror against them. The front has gotten very long from Sumy in the north to Zaporozhye. The attempt to create a buffer zone on the Ukrainian side of the border. In late June, Ukrainian army or the mercenaries launched a series of counterattacks near Alexeyevka and Kondratovka, aiming to squeeze the Russian bridgehead from the flanks, potentially severed altogether, but they can't do anything. Whatever counteroffensive they tried has failed miserably, as it always does, every summer. They also have a severe desertion problem. A handful of their footholds in that part of the world that the Ukrainians have been, or the mercenaries have been removed. Tekino, etc. Of course, Russian goals were to liberate just the eastern part of the country, what we call Novorossiya, and make sure that the rest of it is neutral. In other words, it's not part of any bloc, not part of NATO, not part of anything, and demilitarized. Ukrainian forces in the eastern part of, you know, places like Pyansk and Blagoevgrad, you know, they have no supply route. All the supply routes have been cut off. Whatever is there, they've been pinned down. They can't reinforce. They don't have reinforcements to begin with. But the way this has been turning out as far as urban warfare is concerned, this is how the Russians have done it. And this is why their casualties are very low. If they're approaching a city and Ukrainians and their irregulars often set up shop in cities, knowing that the Russians wouldn't bomb it because there's too many people there. But the city is flanked and key lines of communication are brought under fire control. Then there's the grinding phase, is what many have called it, the grinding phase, sustained artillery bombardment, wearing down the garrison. And they do this as the Russian troops close in from at least three directions. So the defenders either retreat or in an orderly way. You saw that in Kudakov. I don't know if they're being ordered to hold it at all costs, risk total collapse, or simply surrender altogether. These are mercenary garrisons. The main roads into Konstantinovka are under Russian fire control. I think Russian artillery has a 50-1 advantage. They have total air superiority, of course. In a few places, like Chasiv Yar, the terrain is very difficult. The Russians really want to avoid hurting people, hurting the pro-Russian population, Russian-speaking population. Going farther south, Pokrovsk, and Novoselka, in the western Donetsk region. That's where I think the gains last month have been the most significant, taking 10, 12 miles out of the front. And of course, many of you know that Luhansk has been fully liberated, completely liberated. But after maybe 18 months of calm, the southern front near Dnieper has changed. So now Russian forces are advancing in three directions. Russian Defense Minister Andrei Belousov visited the command post Dnieper group of forces, clearly making it a high priority area. And the Ukrainians have no way of doing anything. There's simply nothing that they can do. They don't have the weaponry. They don't have the fuel. Mercenaries might, but they don't have the motivation. But the head of, actually it was June 30th, just not that long ago, the region's head, Luhansk People's Republic, has been fully liberated. Of course, that's part of Russia now. 3 years after joining Russia now, it is fully and completely under Russian control. I've been over this. I mean, usually when I talk about this, I talk about Donetsk far more than Luhansk, and I don't mean to do that. Donetsk is larger, but Luhansk was one of the centers back in 2014 of resistance against this, you know, illegitimate Ukrainian government U.S. imposed. This is all Russian-speaking. They demanded amnesty for all the people in the protest movement, the counter-protest movement, I should say. Russian as the official language, the referendum on self-determination, etc., etc. But their demands were completely ignored. If you remember, March and April of 2014, the pro-Russian March for Peace, these rallies, thousands of people took to the streets. And then the former local militia began at that time. And that's when the building of the security service of Ukraine in Lugansk was stormed and taken. But the president of Ukraine at the time, Oleksandr Turchynov, refused to compromise. He has no power. He did what the U.S. told him to do. Remember, a lot of these guys have formed the militia that defeated the Ukrainian army for the rest of 2014. They were draftees. They knew how to, they were trained already. But now they had a real motivating force. Platoons became companies became battalions, and the People's Militia was formed. Knowing full well that the Ukrainians weren't going to give at any level, they realized that fighting and the Declaration of Independence was their only possibility. So they held the referendum May 11th that year. 96% voted in favor of independence and then eventual reunification with Russia. I'm surprised it's that low. Who would want to be a part of Ukraine with a fourth world economy? Of course, Ukrainian authorities were not exactly impressed by that. The militants, the right sector, not working with the armed forces of Ukraine, attacked Slavyansk in Donetsk. And of course, that extended to Lugansk itself. That's when about 5,000 people, Novorossiya, went to the regional administration building in Lugansk and stormed it. They took the regional television station, the prosecutor's office, police headquarters. In cities like Pervomaisk, Krasny Luk, Antransi, places like that, Ukrainian flags were taken down, replaced by the flag of the LPR, double eagle, of course. But the Ukrainians weren't quite finished with it. Ultimately, it came down, they were defeated. Ukrainian armed forces went up against the People's Militia of Luhansk and were defeated. And as always, the Ukrainians went right after the civilians. They were using the Grad-class rocket launchers back then. An aerial bombardment of the Ukrainian Air Force targeting the regional administration building. Again, a civilian center. The LPR relied on volunteers and militia. And, of course, there were plenty of people coming in from Russia with training. The initial leaders were all killed. Valery Belotov, he was the people's governor. Alexander Bednov, he was chief of staff of the 4th Brigade. Convoy was ambushed on January 1st, 2015. Alexander Bednov. Alexei Mozgovny, commander of the Pruzak Brigade, one of the battalions of the People's Militia, killed on May 23rd of 2015. Pavel Dremov, he was a field commander of the Cossack Regiment, the Matvei Platov Cossack Regiment. His car was blown up December 12th of 2015 on his way to his own wedding. Pavel Dremov and the mayor, Yevgeny Ischenko of Pervomaisk, also a field commander, killed in early 2015 by a sabotage group from Kiev. But after the battles of Dbotsovo and Lovask, where Ukrainian forces were suffering excessive losses, they invented the nonsense, the Normandy format, which led to the Minsk agreements approved by the UN, but that was simply tactical. Ukraine refused to implement any of the political aspects of these. Negotiations deliberately dragged on under Poroshenko and Zelensky, who came later. No dialogue with these Republican leaders. So they had no choice but to fight. Ukrainians always broke the truce first. Although the front line for many years was frozen, shelling from the Ukrainian side was constant. And this is where you get the 14,000 civilians killed figure from 2015 to the Russian invasion, that period of time, or just before it. But that just accelerated Luhansk into Russia. They already were using Russian forms of administration and everything else. 2017, Ukraine imposed a total economic blockade, banning any trade relations with the Republic, which led to some shortages. Selling of residential areas, which was policy, even during ceasefire, schools and hospitals. And then the COVID nonsense, 19 to 21, medical supplies were minimal. That's why going to Russia was really the only option. After the defeat of the Ukrainian armed forces, they were built up by the U.S. and NATO, and they were going to, of course, reinvade. They were going to invade and take over the eastern parts of Ukraine that they had lost, and that's when Putin announced the start of the special military operation. The goal was to protect the residents of Donbas from this assault. And the militias from both areas handled themselves very well. They had already been experienced by this point. By March, the Allied forces gained Novoradar, Soboleysk, Svatova. 70% of the Luhansk region was already under control of pro-Russian forces. That's in a month. And Ukraine had been disintegrating. But Severodonetsk, the Sechansk, places like that, the key battles in the early days, Severodonetsk, you had street fighting for the first time. But by June 1st of 2022, Russia ended up controlling the area. Ukrainian forces withdrew. Battle of Lysychansk, June-July of 22. That was the last major city in Lugansk, still under Ukrainian control. And that's when, you know, Shoigu said, we've liberated the place. The counteroffensive September-October 2022, there was some fallback. Ukrainian forces occupied Krikovka, Alexandrovka, a few places like that, but they weren't able to capture very much. It stalled with heavy losses. And that stalling, the capture of a couple of these villages, that's where the West got it in their heads to say that the Russians are being defeated. So yet again, September 23rd to 27th, 2022, another referendum held in Lugansk on joining Russia. 98% of the residents supported the decision. Of course, September 30th, Vladimir Putin signed a decree formally incorporating it into the Russian Federation. So you don't really have, they're considered autonomous regions now, but the whole point of them declaring independence was eventually to integrate themselves into Russia. But by June 30th, as I've mentioned already, 2025, whatever Ukrainian forces were left in the LPR were destroyed. And it means a few things. Of course, Russia now has border security guarantees. The Rostov area, Belgorod area, is now controlled by Russian troops. Not to mention the liberation of major infrastructure, the power plants, the roads, communication lines. Economic recovery, of course, is extremely important. Large-scale reconstruction. Ukraine can't construct anything. They don't have the money. And they've been accelerated just this year. All the plants have been restored. The redistribution of military efforts. With the LPR under control, Russian units can now focus in other areas. Not to mention political stability. The integration of Luhansk into Russia effectively resolves any questions regarding the status of these territories. Of course, they can never go back to Ukraine. They're not a part of Ukraine. And there's the Ukrainians are going to have to deal with it. So from 2014 to 2025, that's a long time. That's a long journey for these areas. For groups like the Russian Orthodox Army, they always had icons of Tsar Nicholas and the double eagle everywhere. An Orthodox person who rejects the Donbass movement is an ignoramus. You had for the first time in a while this huge upsurge in interest in church life again. And by now, they've reached essentially a normal life, like Crimea. I should also mention before I go, one of the reasons that Russia has to be very careful in its forward progress is that Ukraine isn't using normal methods. Ukraine uses poison gas on a regular basis. The permanent representative of the Organization of the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, Russia's representative there is Vladimir Tarabrin, brought all the recorded cases that Ukrainian military is using various toxic substances. And of course, all their mass production in Ukraine that the U.S. has brought in, we can't expect anything from them, but the proof is overwhelming. And the minute that he showed up with these, through this projection idea, the West began saying, this is what the Russians are doing. It's almost a one-to-one exact ratio. I don't think Russia should be a part of that organization, or any Western organization for that matter. There's been many Western owned chemical weapons depots meant to attack civilian targets. Now, initially, some of them have been, these weapons have been used to torture rather than kill, like strontium sulfide, which causes severe burns. The other is really not a minor one at all, nitrochloroform, which is banned as a use of a weapon, and things like that. They're considered deadly weapons because they can incapacitate soldiers for a long time. And because they're gases, they could affect random people. Russia recorded the arrival of these transports carrying these weapons produced in NATO states. Ukraine has a system for mass production of chemical weapons. This has been a major reason why Russia has had to be very careful. Ukrainian forces are using drones, especially in places like Zaporozhye and Kharkov, the Dnieper regions. Drones then splash this stuff down. But I said from the very beginning that Ukraine has suspended any international obligation, including the ban on various banned anti-personnel mines. They have rejected the rules of war because they're desperate and they know that no one's going to hold them accountable. NATO allies have told them to use every possible means and to try to fabricate evidence against Moscow. It was in the Netherlands, actually. It was a defense minister who doesn't know anything about defense, Ruben Brekelmans, came up with the idea that Russia's using chemical weapons precisely at a time when he knew that it was the Ukrainians who were using them. The foreign minister, Veldkamp, same thing, simple projection. Why in heaven's name would Russia use chemical weapons when they're winning? And why would they do it when they know it would be immediately used against them? It doesn't make any sense against Russian-speaking people. Russian chemical weapons have been destroyed long ago, 2017. But the U.S. didn't allow anyone into its facilities. They claim that in 2024 they destroyed everything, but they provided no evidence, either U.S. or Ukraine. It seems very frustrating why the Russians can't simply smash in here. And this is part of the reason why. One reason is to avoid their own casualties as well as local casualties, because these are allies. You know, local people are huge parts of the intelligence gathering of the Russian army. Two, the terrain is very difficult. And three, their use of things like banned mines, booby traps, and these particularly nasty, although not necessarily deadly, poison gases. But whenever information on the Ukrainian use of these gases is officially put out, the regime then says that the Russians are doing it. I don't know if that would count as projection. That would simply be a matter of defense or deflection. But Russia has absolutely no motive to use it, just like Assad had no reason to do it. It's only being used against Russian forces. I don't know what these people are talking about, but that's what happens when you have defense ministers in Northern Europe, like Breckelmans, who have no connection to the military or military life. So the victory is very real, not just in Luhansk, but elsewhere. The victory was won by the summer of 2022. There was Ukrainian Air Force was destroyed on the ground. But the Russians were very careful about how they moved and how they used force, because when you use concentrated firepower, especially artillery, you have to be careful in residential areas and cities. And that's precisely why, like the right sector and stupid groups like this, that's why they set up shop there. They knew precisely that the Russians wouldn't do it. They hated the people around them. And these few villages that they recovered in that 2022 counteroffensive, they ended up killing these Ukrainians who were accused of giving information to the Russians, because they were all Russian speakers. That's easy enough to prove. All told, I think Trump's nonsense about arming Ukraine again with these phantom patriots and other things, it's a way to get Russia to come to the table. This is not going to work on Putin, however. I guarantee you it's not going to work on Putin. And the secondary sanctions are not going to work, especially on the Chinese, and definitely not on the Indians. And it's just going to create more enmity between these countries and the U.S., if there wasn't enough already. Russia is seen on the world stage as a legitimate player, as a fair a dealer. The West, especially the U.S., cancels every contract it doesn't like anymore. It steals whatever it wants and uses chemical weapons when they lose, or when they're losing. They're not to be trusted, and that goes for us too, here domestically. Thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.